every one of those communities that could see the success of the canal, read about the success of the canal, we want one. If it could work over there, it can work over here. Why not? We've got water. We've got ground we can create a box of water in. How tough can it be?
This is Before Your Time, presented by the Vermont Historical Society and Vermont Humanities. Every episode, we go inside the stacks at the Vermont Historical Society to take a look at an object from their permanent collection that tells us something unique about our state. Then, we take a closer look at the people, the events, or the ideas that surround each artifact. The objects that we're looking at for these episodes are maps. Each one represents a different moment in Vermont, with questions that spiral out and persist to our present day. Today's map describes something that never actually happened. It comes to us courtesy of the National Archives, and it's a manuscript map, so it was never published, drawn by three Army surveyors who spent the summer of 1829 exploring a potential canal route that would have connected Lake Champlain and the Connecticut River. The map focuses on an area east of Montpelier, and it proposes to use Kettle Pond and Peacham Ponds as water sources for a canal route that would have made the final connection from the Winooski River in Montpelier to the Wells River, and from then on to the Connecticut River. It's really quite a beautiful map, but it's hard to understand the scale of what you're looking at until you see just how small Kettle Pond is by contrast. Today, Kettle Pond is a centerpiece of Groton State Park. How would it and the city of Montpelier have been different in this alternate history if the canal project had succeeded? To really understand this map, we have to understand Montpelier. And Montpelier as it existed in its earliest days, before it was the city that we know today. We should also take a moment to acknowledge that Montpelier was settled in the 18th century on unceded Abenaki territory, though the early European settlers considered it empty.
Think of Montpelier as frontier. You know, central and northern Vermont was nothing like southern New England. It was very wild, remote.
Paul grew up in Montpelier.
My name is Paul Heller, and I live in Barrie, Vermont.
He's an historian of central Vermont who has written many books, including several on the history of the capital.
When Jacob Davis, who we consider the founder of Montpelier, came to Montpelier in 1787 with his nephew, Parley Davis, and a hired man, they were building everything from scratch. They immediately set to building a log cabin. Parley Davis, by the way, went up country a bit. He went up to East Montpelier and built a wonderful home and farmed up there. But Jacob Davis saw the possibilities of the waterways, the North Branch and the Winooski River, and he settled down in the valley.
Speaking of, it hasn't always been the seat of state government.
Montpelier became the capital by default. There was a tussle between the people in the Connecticut River Valley and the people in the Champlain Valley. Neither would let the other have the capital, so they compromised on Montpelier. And also, Montpelier had agreed to build them a state house, which they started when it was made the capital in 1805 and completed in 1808.
Montpelier could also be a pretty lively town.
Chester Wright was the first settled minister in Montpelier. This is in what he wrote about Montpelier in 1811 in the Vermont Evangelical magazine. The first settlers, not being disposed to encourage an attention to religious concerns, no religious order was observed in the place for a number of years. The inhabitants, as might be expected, became generally dissipated, and a deplorable state of morals was the result. The Sabbath, instead of being observed as a day of holy rest, was improved as a season of relaxation from ordinary business. Only for purpose of amusement, convivial entertainments at public houses, sleigh riding, trading, or gambling, in the language of profanity, was the common dialect.
So now we have a picture of Montpelier around the time these engineers were imagining their canal. And as we were all sadly reminded this summer, Montpelier is situated on a major river, the Winooski. So it was used to the idea of water travel. But what exactly is a canal? And how is it different from just a regular river?
My name is Art Cohn. I am a nautical archaeologist who's been studying the history and archaeology of the region for almost 40 years. And I think the easiest way for modern people to appreciate it is to think about a highly engineered water highway, a box of water that allows boats to travel from point A to point B, carrying some type of a load, whether it's people like a bus or freight like a tractor trailer.
Art is also probably the person in the state of Vermont who knows the most about canals.
I'm the director emeritus of the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum and an affiliated scholar with the Institute of Nautical Archaeology at Texas A&M.
So of course we turned to him to ask about this imagined canal and the whole system that it was supposed to be part of.
It was regulated. It was inspected like a modern highway. There were rules about size of the vessels, just like the size of the trucks that are allowed on the highway today. And the canals were largely built to provide larger loads of cargo and goods to move to market from the hinterlands, and were also used to move people. The only alternative when before canals opened for moving people were stagecoaches, which were operating usually on horrible roads with lots of jostling and movement, and in heavy rains the roads could be closed. So by contrast, the smooth water, uniform depth canal was I've equated it to the development of the internet. It was a quantum leap in the transportation technology that existed at the time. And as we've witnessed, the day the canal opened, our whole world changed.
Canals represented a huge jump forward in so many things: economics, transportation, culture, and, of course, engineering.
And they really were marvelous feats of engineering. One of the great things about studying the canal is you're really seeing a bunch of creative mechanics, mathematicians, school teachers converting themselves into the America's first generation of engineers. And the problem solving they had to do to make the canal work was extraordinary.
So you can imagine it. All this possibility, all this energy, and all those brilliant people. And then came the spectacular success of the Erie Canal.
All of a sudden, anybody who was not actually on the canal but could see it, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 miles away, and had a stream that went someplace meandering along, went crazy. It was actually called canal fever. Obviously, every place that wasn't actually on the canal, particularly think about every community has its movers and shakers. The guy that owns the mill, the guy that owns the forest, the guy that's a very successful farmer growing huge quantities of flour. The secret is getting that stuff to market in an economically viable way. And if you're on the canal, you've got it. If you're close to the canal, you got it. If you're not on the canal and not close to it, you are now at an economic disadvantage and a business disadvantage. And so every one of those guys, every one of those communities that could see the success of the canal, read about the success of the canal, we want one. If it could work over there, it can work over here. Why not? We've got water. We've got ground we can create a box of water in. How tough can it be? We can make it work. And so their optimism and their wishful thinking drove a lot of very bad ideas.
Bad ideas like joining Lake Champlain and the Connecticut River via canals.
When we get to our area, Vermont, you've got an even better example of canal mania driving feasibility surveys. And thank goodness somebody realized that with the elevations that had to be overcome and the complex engineering of getting water to the canal year for the whole navigation season. So in the dead of summer, if you got a canal that can float a 4-foot boat, you got to provide 4 feet worth of water. And both those became major stumbling blocks for the canal that was to connect Lake Champlain to the Connecticut River, as depicted on the map.
The interest in canals was not unlike our own push for broadband internet access today. They made a huge difference in the economic prospects of an area.
The people in the communities all along that potential route, and they didn't really know what the route was going to be. The Winooski River, the Onion River, from Lake Champlain to Montpelier was pretty much a given. But how you got from Montpelier to the Connecticut River was what they were initially going to try to figure out. And so a whole series of surveys were commissioned to look at different routes. And usually those routes had a big river system to support some of it, but it wasn't quite enough to get the whole way. And it wasn't necessarily enough to keep it in water once the summer came and you were using water to fill those locks and empty them. And so as much as canal mania drove the surveys, drove the let's look at this, we really want it. I'm a Montpelier businessman. If I can get on this water highway, I can geometrically increase my business and become rich.
People in Montpelier were definitely looking at canals as the next big thing that was going to turn the city into an economic powerhouse.
Yeah, people thought of it as a manufacturing center. You know, today we think of Barrie maybe as an industrial center, but that aspect of the granite industry was sort of later in the 19th century. And Montpelier was, they were just making stuff there, foundries and mills, you know, manufacturing all kinds of things. And the railroad, of course, made that much more profitable.
Whole parts of Montpelier were mills or factories. Even with slower transportation before railroads, people made pretty much anything you can imagine, from shoes to clothespins in Montpelier. But what would it have looked like to turbocharge that?
I imagine it would have changed Montpelier, and I think we would have seen maybe a more extensive blue-collar workforce, you know, people to work in the various industrial factories. And there would have been a different kind of housing, you know, worker housing, smaller buildings, perhaps. You know, Montpelier still has a lot of grand homes, and it gives you a sense of the kind of wealth that it had. And people today, I think, would be surprised at how rich they were in the early 19th century. And fortunes were made there. Langdon made a lot of money. Pitkin made a lot of money. And some of it was made through maybe financial means, but a lot of it was made by manufacturing things.
So they pushed for it. And to some extent, the communities sometimes underwrote the surveys. The communities underwrote it in part, and government might kick in a little bit of money. But those feasibility surveys, looking at the various routes, thank goodness they realized that it would be like building a stairway to the moon.
the challenges of building the proposed canal derailed the project, pun intended, because it was the next phase of transportation innovation that really opened up Vermont.
What they didn't see coming was the next innovation in transportation technology, the railroad. And so almost overnight, the railroads outcompeted these extraordinary packet boats, which only 25 years earlier were the marvels of their age. Now they were obsolete and they began to disappear. By the age of photography, most of them were already gone, which is why we have very few photographic images of packet boats.
In just a few very short decades, canals were outcompeted as transportation. Vermont was on to the next big thing.
A railroad is, go to the basic words, it's a road. And instead of being on dirt or paving stones or some other hard surface, it's on rails.
Bill Badger is from Rutland. He's a founding member of the Rutland Railroad Historical Society and a retired architect. And he has a wealth of knowledge about railroads in Vermont.
And the first railroads were developed in England. They were moving coal around. And they were using wagons, horse-drawn wagons. And somebody got the brilliant idea that if they put down rails, in this case wooden rails, with turned up edges on the inside to keep the wheels on, that it was much more efficient, less friction, and the horse could carry more, could pull more. And that developed into a better form of transportation than a horse. They were already using steam engines, not locomotives, but engines in the coal mines to pump water out. So they had these steam engines and they just started playing around with the idea of putting that form of power onto a mobile platform and moving along under its own power. And first it was specifically for coal. And then as railroads developed in the US and in a certain extent in England also, water was still the main form of transportation. So a city like Baltimore or New York or Boston might build a railroad out into the country that was feeding material from the city out to the hinterland and bringing products, agricultural products and stuff into the city. So it was an extension of the existing ship culture, if you will. And that was where the first railroads were built.
He explained that railroads were more flexible than canals, and perhaps most importantly for Vermont, they were year-round and they could go up hills.
The other thing about canals is they're a lot more difficult to build than a railroad. You got to build a ditch, and it has to be level, because water has this nasty habit of wanting to be level. And as soon as you get to any kind of change of elevation, you have to build locks and step the boats up, and they were slow. You know, a mule towing a boat walked at about 2 miles an hour. So even on a long day, I read on the Erie Canal, they were doing 18-hour days, and they'd make 36 miles a day. Even an early railroad train at 20 to 25 miles an hour was 10 to 15 times faster than the canal. You didn't have to worry about freezing in the winter. You could go, in spite of being steel on steel, there's a certain amount of friction. You could go up a grade, 1%, even up to 2% more for secondary lines. So you could go over obstacles, especially if you kind of wound around and kept the grade down. You could go over mountains without having to build locks.
Railroads were so much easier and cheaper to build, in fact, that they could be temporary.
A canal, you wouldn't build a canal and not hope for some longevity out of it. But railroads, you could build up into the woods as a logging railroad and its lifespan might be 5 years. And when that was logged out, you pulled the rails up and you threw it down somewhere else. The Rich Lumber Company came from Pennsylvania to Wanakena, New York, and then up to Manchester, 1913, 1915, built a huge mill and built a railroad up the Lybrook Hollow into timberland up above that nobody had really been able to access. They'd been accessing it with a railroad coming up from the south, but hadn't gotten all the way up the Deerfield River Railroad. So they built this switchback that wandered up the mountain. It only lasted 4 years because somebody grossly underestimated the amount of timber up there. And then the mill burned.
Railroads quickly became the point of access to the larger world for so much of Vermont. And they made it possible for larger scale industry to ship product beyond New England.
So little sawmills in Townsend and places like that could market their lumber elsewhere, not just be a local thing. There were stories on the West River. It was a small railroad that, if a farmer had a few dozen eggs going out and he was short one egg, they would wait for the hen to cooperate. But the point is, whether or not it was true, the point is that, it allowed people to market whatever, to do whatever they were going to do and market it beyond local needs. And also for people to come in, buy stuff, bring materials in. If you had a country store in Jamaica, well, you probably got material from the railroad. There's a great big building in downtown Reedsboro. Now, Reedsboro was famous for chairs. They had a huge chair factory. And they had the Hoosick Tunnel and Wilmington Railroad that went out to the Boston and Maine connection, Hoosick Tunnel. All that chair business probably would not have been practical were it not for the railroad. And this big building that was in downtown was a store. And the back dropped off, and there was a little door and loading dock at the back of the store, and the Hoosick Tunnel in Wilmington would drop off a boxcar of material for the store. So they were getting it direct from the railroad.
Railroads, and more specifically, the refrigerated railroad car, also had an impact you probably don't even realize. We talked about it in a previous episode. Go give it a listen, but the short version is that they're at least partly responsible for the change from Jersey to Holstein cows on the dairy farms of Vermont. All of the things we've talked about today, the way Montpelier became a city, the way canals boomed and then busted, and the transportation revolution of the railroad, that all came out of one map for a canal that never existed. Before Your Time is presented by Vermont Humanities and the Vermont Historical Society. This episode was produced by Amanda K. Gustin, that's me, Ryan Neuswanger, and Noel Clark. Thanks to our guests, Paul Heller, Art Cohn, and Bill Badger. Special thanks for the support of this limited series goes to the Lake Champlain Basin Program and their Champlain Valley National Heritage Partnership Corridor of Commerce granting program. Visit our website, beforeyourtime.org, to find a scan of the map and other images and sources related to this episode. And if you like what you hear, please tell your friends about this podcast. Thanks for listening.